Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
Ed Jin.
With guest co-hosts.
Chris Quantum Tarantino.
I don't know if you guys read, but I read an interesting book. Yeah.
I'm sorry, we should just have it. I don't know if you guys read, period.
Yeah.
Oh, troll, yes,
oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Welcome to number 155. You've got myself, Jay, Quantum Tarantino here. We've got Dan, we've got Mackie, we've got Mad Jin, and we've got John, who's stepped up and will be with us here today.
155 alive!
Number 5 is alive, what?
Commerce flowchart for Civilization 4, started by Mech Anti Kethra back in December of last year, but has updated it to version 1.4 as of July 30th. What started all of this? Well, he says, I noticed during a culture game that I was still unsure about the finer points of distinction between commerce, gold, and wealth, in terms of which sources were modified by which civics and buildings, I just couldn't say. So I decided to make it visual and try to learn it that way. This is something that is better represented visually than in writing or even verbally, but I'm going to try here. Base commerce, your commerce modifiers, and your slider that is also combined with science, culture, gold, and what I call a combination of all of these things. So without going into science, culture, gold, or combo at this point, let's just talk about commerce straight up. You've got your base commerce, which is your palace and your capital, your trade routes between your cities and other cities, as the case apply, and or, and worked tiles. You have commerce modifiers in the form of civics. For example, bureaucracy available at civil service, where you get plus 50% gold in the capital. And you also have your slider, which for commerce and culture and gold and with the Beyond the Sword expansion, also espionage, can range from 0 to 100%. And then this person decided to go through and show us, okay, what other modifiers impact commerce other than commerce itself. So with science, you've got your raw beakers. Again, you've got the slider. You've got great people. If you happen to have the representation government civic, then that also modifies it, just like if you have the University of Sankor, Wonder of the World, because you get plus 2 beakers from all state religions in your city. But you also have beaker modifiers. So, for example, free religion, which you can get at liberalism, is plus 10% research in all cities. Culture, you've got your raw culture. Again, slider. Your own religion, you've got great people, you've got buildings, you've got culture modifiers, again, another civic, free speech available at liberalism, plus 100% culture in all cities. If you also happen to have the Sistine Chapel, Wonder of the World, and if you don't, you're probably very happy when it's built by someone beside you, it's plus 2 culture from specialists in all cities and plus 5 culture from all state religion buildings. I almost said that without laughing. And then also, if you happen to have the culture trait, that's another modifier, that's plus 2 culture per city. If you include Beyond the Sword, that applies to 11 leaders from Augustus Caesar of the Romans, say through Zara Yaqob of the Ethiopians. Gold, raw gold, slider, great people, buildings, your market, your bank, your grocer, and of course your national wonder of Wall Street. If you also happen to have the spiral minaret, that's plus 1 gold from all state buildings. And last but not least is the combination of raw hammers, hammer modifiers such as bureaucracy, hammer conversion, again with bureaucracy, plus 50% hammers, and which could also be applied to research and culture, and then raw beakers, culture and gold, 2 buildings, that's selling resources and or technology to the AI, or I suppose fellow humans too, begging for gold, pillaging, bulbing a technology, a trade mission from a great merchant, and of course, the best, air quote best, getting gold from constructing a wonder, but someone beating you to it. Otherwise known as
fail cash.
Mm. I know all of these things were in there, but I didn't think about, you know, necessarily what came before something else after kind of the base modifiers and how it all worked together and how you can actually have overlap with some things, certain combinations of things. A commerce modifier, basic, obviously, for civics would be any economic civic, sans, you know, despotism, you know, things like that. I've been playing this game for, let's see, Civilization IV came out in 2005, then an expansion pack each successive year. I first bought it in 2006, so about 6 years, and it was nice to see this in a visual representation, and it's an image that you could print out as well and have sitting in front of you. I thank not only MechAnti Kerithra for first creating this and then sharing it with the rest of us, but also saying to the community, is there anything that needs to be changed, added, modified, made clearer, and has been continuing to update it?
Yeah, it's odd. It's one of these things that I sort of understood it just from having played and stuff, but when I see it laid out like this visually, it sinks in better somehow.
Visualizations always help.
So I can seem to figure out on low culture, the great prophet settled in the city, and they don't give culture.
Yeah, you also have to keep in mind, if you read through the thread, he hasn't quite gotten to BTS.
Oh.
Apparently he's been working through Vanilla and Warlords and hasn't quite made it to BTS yet. So this whole chart would need to be updated again.
One more time.
But at least it's a basis for it.
I like it. Well, I mean, this is stuff I've figured out by playing, so I'm not sure how. I guess it's very nice for an introduction to the game. If you're unfamiliar with all these variables, then this is wonderful.
Well, it's also even keeping people from mixing up commerce and gold. A nice visual chart like this helps show that commerce is not gold.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, now let's describe the colors of the chart. So, no, we're not going to do that. We're not going to actually do that.
Yeah, guys trying to start color, that's going to go great.
It's a nice color.
Yeah, exactly.
Still in Civilization IV, and that's really the only segue I can think of.
Instead of when bears attack, it's when bears don't attack. No, over on COC, Rifle and Joe started this topic. He posted a little screenshot from where there was a bear close to his scout. He's going, why didn't it eat my scout for dinner? It just kind of wandered off. And when I looked at it, I noticed it's really early in the game, and I was thinking, isn't there a grace period where they don't attack? Or at least, I know something like we get the first attack has a bonus or something that it's easier to survive, but they also don't, animals don't come into your borders. I was just wondering that also they don't attack early. And maybe it's a difficulty level setting. I don't know.
Well, sometimes they just don't attack. I mean, as you say, very early in the game, they're usually not. But even later, I think it might be the odds. But then again, a bear always has good odds on a scout. So.
Yeah, that's not even on a forest hill either. Bear's got a decent chance. What is an orange scout for breakfast?
Yeah, there might be something on the map we can't see. Maybe. How far do the animals see? Is there something more important he's going for?
Yeah, there could also be, like, another scout from somebody else right below it. That's even more weak.
Yeah.
And tastier.
Well, it could be that bears are not the savage monsters that we led to believe.
Yeah, not hungry today.
They're just hungry for salmon.
Ataki Waxton says in the thread that animals shun aggression 10% of the cases. So that is a hard-coded fact. Now, I'm just based on what the fact he's saying. I never really thought about that, but I more appreciated what he said a little later in the post, which was there are two levels of barb behaviors according to how advanced global expansion. That's the average number of cities per player of AIs plus the human player. First level of attitude, the barbs are attracted to juicy pillaging improvement at a certain distance. The second level of attitude and the final one is the distance crewed. Thus, barbs are starting to ignore camping units. So it does seem like if in its two-tile movement range, if it sees something that is damaged in any way, it is more likely to attack that one than not. But it's still random number generated. It's not a guarantee. And he also says that there's an advanced tactic in warfare, like using a scout or a worker to bait a stack to delay the onset. So I guess this applies to barbs, too. I really don't think about barbarian stacks so much, but we have seen that. Between a city and a bait unit, though, it won't work all of the time because those units often have a city attack modifier, so preferring cities if they're really weakened, and odds for the AI are overwhelming.
So if it's got a wounded archer on a hill versus an archer on the plains, it's still going to go after the wounded one because it still has better odds even though it can be fortified?
Yes, I believe so. Even if it has a choice between, say, that and maybe a scout nearby that is fully healed, the fact that it is injured, as long as it's also within its vicinity, it's more likely to go after that which is injured.
Okay.
Actually, this reminds me, there was a forum post back in an internal forum for one of the games I'm in, and they did a test with the whole barbarian thing and put about 10 lions on 10 islands with a worker and let it, you know, roll to see what would happen. And I think 1 out of 10, the lion did not affect in all the tests.
I believe that test was referred to in a thread called All Knowing AI from October 2009 that Tay Wecky referenced. I liked his summary of the thread, because it gets a little technical for those not mod-minded of us, I would say. Essentially, that the AI doesn't remember your movements turn to turn, so to get around this, AI units can see as far as they can move each turn. This creates the unfortunate side effect of units with two or more moves away always knowing where your units are if they are in range, which is why panthers and wolves always track you down, and the AI oil-powered naval units appear to cheat.
Mm-hmm.
Cheating. Whatever.
Like, whatever, it's before, I don't care.
Yeah. No. Yeah, obviously, back in so far, they didn't have the powerful computing of today, so they had to give the AI some way to move units around without actually giving them, like, some insane amount of code just to have it follow around.
From Hobbs Yo-Yo, he says he's looking forward to listening today. This show is perfect for when I'm doing the dishes, among other chores that require my eyes but not my ears.
Well, I have listened to Turncast episodes while I'm doing the dishes, so.
I had asked him in response how long he'd been listening to the show, how did he find it, after episode 153 came out, and then went back and listened through the older episodes and seasons.
Wow.
I said, is that few of them, some of them, is that all of them? And he said, no, it was almost all of them. So in a period of 2 weeks, he listened to easily more than 160, 170 hours.
Holy crap.
It's a lot of dishes.
That is nuts.
Works at a restaurant.
Hey, there you go. Oh, he's in the dishwasher spit. Yeah, that'd work.
I was going to say maybe they had a family reunion, and the family is rather large, so he was doing a lot of dishes.
See, a hell of a large family.
He said, I found out about the show through the front page of CFC. I just joined, or otherwise I probably would have heard about Polycast sooner. And then he says, and what the heck do I have to do to get name dropped as Hobbs Yo-Yo, the up-and-coming CFC-er with a penchant for Beethoven? Haha, just kidding.
Well, there you go.
Haha, just kidding. Well, fine. Listeners will disregard my previous comment about his title. There we go. You know that works in court. And then Jabberwock Zeno said, I just started listening to the show and really enjoy it. I like how you split it up to go over every game in the franchise, even if I only really like Civ Rev and Civ 5. Couldn't stand the user interface in Civ 4.
What?
How long could we talk about this?
There's a user interface in this game? What?
What? I thought it was just random button pressing.
What's wrong with it? It's just, well, the way it is, it's just, that's it for you. There's no alternative, okay? It works fine.
Let's talk about the user interface in Civilization 3. Wait, no, let's not.
Let's talk about Civ 3, period, about that.
Yeah. I'll end up in a few positions trying
Civ Rev is, of course, referring to our sibling show Revcast, and Mackie referred to Turncast, which is on cooperative multiplayer, or at least what passes for cooperative multiplayer.
There's no competing in Turncast.
Nope, not at all.
Competing for trolls. It's a troll doll competition.
looking in the chat as we're discussing this, Canis Albinus says that I've done that, so perhaps you can clarify, and Canis Albinus called into our last episode, but you can just say in the chat, does this mean that once you found Polycast, maybe relatively recently, that you went through our archive of episodes in a very short period of time? In fairness here, Hobbs Yo-Yo is not the first person who has said that, but he's the latest person that said that, although now Canis Albinus, by answering my question by saying yes, just turned me into a bit of a liar, but oh well. Canis Albinus is now the latest person that has said that. Zippy's Guitar says in the chat, Polycast Virgin here, and he says he's enjoying what he's hearing so far. Seems like he found the show on CFC. So here's a challenge to you, Zippy's Guitar. Hobby Yo-Yo said that, you know, in an overbooked period of 2 weeks, he went back and listened to the entire show archive. If you can do that in less time, we'll give you a virtual cookie.
How about we just give him a virtual cookie for listening?
Oh, we can't give cookies to everybody.
No?
You have to earn the cookies.
You can't make more batches of cookies.
No, you have to earn it. Otherwise, it's worth nothing.
Mackie, we do not want to devalue the virtual cookie, okay?
It's a valuable currency, right?
Yes.
If you don't know if it's a valuable currency or not, Mackie, I'm certainly not going to tell you. And the great Mr. Popo says that the YouTube videos are where the addiction starts. Blame Magin. Well, I think a lot of people blame Magin for a lot of things. It's usually Phil, but Phil's not here, so we'll blame Magin. Sure, that's good. I'm fine with that. Meto63 said, for episode 153, I just listened to Settling Great Person Improvement section again, and I still don't really get it. What exactly was the conclusion reached in that discussion? All that I got from it was that the best tiles for it are sheep, cows, and Petra Desert tiles. And, of course, he's referring to which tiles do you settle great people on for their improvements, such as the Great Engineer Manufacturing or the Academy from the Great Scientist. He says, I'm about to start up a Babylon game, and I still have no idea what tiles I should settle my scientist on if I am unlucky and have no sheep or cows around. So he's saying sheep and cows, Petra Desert tile, and non-river grassland, question mark.
Yeah, question mark, question mark. Martin and I had a wonderful conversation about what to settle on. I think we were actually more agreed than what he just made it out to be. Basically, as long as you have one of those, you know, bonus resource tiles to drop it on, you're generally pretty good. Now, you wouldn't use wheat on a river necessarily for that because those come in early and give you lots of food. But, you know, the sheep and the cow, because it gives you a bit of food and something else on top of whatever you're dropping it on, is always good. And there's a building, in that case the stable, that gives you extra production on top of that. So that's why it's generally considered the best. Not to mention sheep, well, it adds food when you improve it to a pasture and then eventually adds another food. So it's not really getting you much out of that. That's why most people would prefer dropping great people on sheep. Cows, of course, they start at three food, so they not only cover their own food of two cost for working the tile, but they give you an extra one, and if you happen to have a sheep as well with a great person, so then you can use one cow, one sheep with two great person tiles, and you'll be food neutral on those two workers. So that's generally the point. Now, for the non-river grassland, since that seems to be the point that people were questioning, early in the game, they're pretty useless. Even if you farm them, you're only going to get one food more than the two, so you'll be up at three. If you trading post it early in the game, you just have one extra gold. So there's always something better to work. But if you're trying to grow, then you need food. So if you drop a great person on a non-river grassland tile, you'll at least get the two food back from working the tile if you're working that particular improvement. Some people say that's not enough because two food to pay for two food is not great. But I counter with if you keep dropping great people and academies on tiles that do not have food or have very little food, then you have to add more workers working farms. That means the number of workers that you need to work those academies starts going up far faster than you would like, and you can get yourself into a situation where you don't have enough workers to work all your academies because you need to actually stop and work a bunch of farms just to work the academies and not grow. that's the situation you really don't want to find yourself in, where you have too many things to work and not enough food to work it.
This has to do with the civilization brought in the Gods and Kings expansion pack, and Prince Caspian, in response to episode 154, wants to know what we think about this AI, specifically on Deity. Is it broken, dead, strong, okay, weak, quote-unquote?
I will go with quote-unquote. You left it as an option, so that's the one I'm going to take. Anyways, Matrok says, hello, I am a veteran player and reader of this forum, but until now I haven't really posted much. Okay. He wants to know, is Austria broken on higher difficulties or just plain broken? And he says he usually plays on immortal difficulty. He says, basically the AI cheats and there's other problems, but what he's really concerned about is the fact that if you leave the Austrian AI alone for very, very long periods of time, they will eventually diplomatic marry most, if not all, of the city-states on the map. And of course, diplomatic marriage costs 500 gold, and you have to be an ally of the city-state first, and that's their unique ability, and you get all their stuff. That's the part that people tend to disagree with. It's the fact that it's cheap and you get all of their stuff. So you get all of the military and everything else. And he posted an image showing themselves at turn 277 and Austria, well, red's all over the map because that's where all the city-states were. Now, I do have to wonder why he let it get that far. And that's actually what most of the people in the thread have suggested, is why have you let the Austrian AI get that far and getting towards taking out everything? And then there was some pot shots at his actual gameplay, which I won't take those shots, but I would suggest that he needs to watch some basic videos. cross-promotion the other way. Take that to work on some of that. Because he should have had no problem going after Austria in there and keeping them cut down on their stealing. Now, is the actual mechanic broken? I don't think it's broken. It's just really easy. All you have to do is become an ally and throw 500 gold at them. And, of course, the AIs on higher difficulty levels have a lot of gold hanging around. Unless, of course, you take it all. So, yes. Austria will get a lot of city-state allies. But you know what's cool about that? If you want a diplomatic victory, you can do it without city-states being around, because you just have to play nice with everybody else due to city-states losing their vote. And, of course, losing their status as a city-state. I think that's the most important aspect of that. Once they're diplomatic married, they are no longer city-states. You can't bring them back or anything. And if Austria does it enough, the actual number of votes you require for the diplomatic victory slowly goes down to just the number of civs that started in the game. If you're playing nice and Austria is in the game and they're soaking up all the city-states, eventually you can just win diplomatically. Yeah, it's actually easier with Austria in the game because you don't have to worry about constant cooing and a bunch of civs going after all of the city-states. Once they remove them from the game, well, it just gets easier and easier. The gold cost should increase. She does become a runaway if all the city-states are very close together, because Austria does get all of the units. And that has led to some amusing situations where, since they do happen to get all of the units when you diplomatic marry, at least as the player, I have no problems with gifting all of my military to a city-state on the other continent, waiting for them all to arrive. waiting for them all to arrive and going, yoink, thanks. Now I have my whole military across the planet. Yay!
And there's also the upgrade point as well.
Yeah. Yes, there's quite a few things in there. Since city-states are really good at upgrading their units, much more than most of the AIs, just because they only have one city and small set of units, city-states, once they get the techs available, will automatically upgrade all of their units, at least as quickly as possible anyways, as long as they have the strategic resources. And so you can just build a bunch of basic units, hand them off to a city-state, watch them get upgraded, and then once they're all upgraded and you are the city-state ally, then you can soak that city-state and get a bunch of free upgrades. Slightly broken.
It only slightly.
Yeah, just a little slightly. So, I personally think you should not get any of the units because that's just a little silly. 500 gold, probably a little low, especially since you keep all the buildings. You're not technically conquering the city-state. You're marrying. So you get all their stuff, which usually costs far more than 500 gold. Of course, if it's a mercantile city-state, then you get personal access to porcelain or jewelry, depending on which one that particular city-state had. So you can get even more stuff out of it.
To distill what Magin has explained in some considerable detail here, when it comes to how Austria currently is in the game, if you yourself are not Austria...
Kill him.
I was going to be a little more diplomatic about it, which was that an ounce of prevention is better than a pound of cure when it comes to dealing with Austria.
Squish Austria now, in other words.
Or have the other AIs do it. I mean, for a little plug on my Mayan Let's Play, Austria was in the game, and there was a ton of city-states out there that couldn't be taken over by, like, the Mongols or other people. And between the Babylonians and the Mongols, they both destroyed Austria slowly but surely over time. So Austria could not diplomatic marry any city-state. So when in doubt, use diplomacy and have the AI do it for you.
There you go.
I have to troll one of his statements, though, Motrak. Says, Austria was building the Apollo project while I am researching chemistry. And I'm going to point out something that saying that you're researching a tech at turn 277, you could have had all of radio and everything else and still not have gone to chemistry. So.
Yeah, that's not.
That doesn't. I could say, you're building the Apollo project while I was researching sailing because, you know, I have tanks.
Yeah.
Minor troll point there. I tried to add Phil, channel a little Phil in there, into that topic. Or the opposite way is, need more work.
Speaking of working, medical lads and marines, hey.
Do they work?
Yeah. I didn't realize medical labs cost as much as.
Yeah.
I'm sitting there thinking, you know, the heck with trying to grow the city, I could build some tanks to that.
The good old medical lab, where you get plus 25% food is carried over after a new citizen is born. The effect stacks with an aqueduct, but you do not get a medical lab until the atomic era. And I think, to me, that's a big reason not to construct the medical lab.
Yeah, it's kind of like with the research labs from Civ 4. They come so late.
Yeah,
but they have the spaceship production in Civ 4. That's valuable.
Yeah, but by the time you could get the research labs built in all the cities, you could have already built the spaceship.
Yeah, fair enough.
I could see a medical lab being more enticing for a tall empire, especially if you were going for maybe a cultural victory, but... For a wide empire, the medical lab may also be actually good spaceship victory, too, so you could, well, not necessarily working more tiles, but have more specialists. But other than that, aqueduct, I see, yes. Hospital, I see, yes. But a medical lab, I can't remember the last time I built one of those in Civ 5. Maybe by accident.
Oh, that's a medical lab? Yeah. Is it that thing that I should have built about 5 turns before I won?
Yes.
That's generally people's point when it comes to the medical lab and some of the late game buildings, is that they're highly expensive. I mean, all the hammers you would put into that?
500.
And yeah, also the aqueduct, which you get so many years earlier, is only 360 hammers and gives you 40% food carried over.
Ah, except some, as somebody said, the math shows that you get 41 point whatever carried over of that leftover 66%. So, haha.
Haha.
And then somebody countered with, surplus food becomes more effective.
Great Mr. Popo says in the chat, the late game buildings are probably to boost you when you have a gold-based game and need the boost to production, which is actually towards what I was saying toward if you're going for a spaceship victory for the spaceship parts.
Well, I mean, well, on that point, then more pop means you can actually work those academies and the specialists and still have some production left over. But in that particular case, medical lab probably is better just to buy. There was a thread somewhere about with the that somebody actually had all the different cost ratios. I think it's about 2.5 2.5 or 2.7 gold to hammer ratio. At that point, if you have a high enough gold per turn, you can easily buy off the medical labs. And generally, the point behind the medical lab, at least the game point, I would probably suggest, is the fact that if you need that extra boost towards the end to get more and more population, build more things and build more late game stuff, then you somewhat do need it, because the point behind it is chopping off the amount of food you require to hit that next population point. The more you cut that box down, the less food you actually need. And if you're up at, you know, the 30-ish pop range, then a medical lab will actually save you an immense amount of food if you keep growing. And that's the big point. If you're not growing anymore and you're not looking to add more than one or two more pop to your city, then it's not worth it, because you're just not going to recover those hammers or the gold in time before the end of the game.
Smote says in the thread that perhaps they being the medical lab, are of extra value in later starts than the ancient era. And I would still counter with the, well, what is your intention? Are you tall or a wide empire? What's your victory condition? I suppose ever so slightly the fact you're starting in something later than the ancient era, maybe, but I think that's negligible without taking into account, okay, you've built it. Why? Or you want to build it. Why? And then with that, in the same inquiry from Prince Caspian, what about Marines? Also, does anyone actually use them, being so deep inside the tech tree? Well, given that Marines have amphibious assault, so attack from the sea or over a river without the 50% combat penalty otherwise, they have extra sight while embarked. I think it's plus one, but I'm not sure. And they defend at double strength embarkation. They are good in combination with melee units, so yes, and I'm talking gods and kings here, because yes, gods and kings, melee ships can take cities. And so there's a related thread. Someone says, what's the point of Marines if ships can take cities? Well, you can use the ships to attack the cities, Marines to then move in and then defend and or heal, but then also continue moving inland where your ships can't actually get to. But I would say that yes, that is a particular circumstance, and I'm more likely to be building infantry, and definitely more likely to be building infantry if I really don't have a map that has any kind of water on it at all, at least any water that has any strategic importance in terms of actually going on the water to go somewhere else to take over another AI's cities and or city-states.
Yeah, and you also have to consider they get the boosted embark defense. And by boosted, I mean it's not just the cheap stuff that they get. They get basically double what everything else has. So they will survive in the water by themselves, even against naval units. So you don't have to defend that army quite as much when you're wandering through the water. And, well, hey, you know what? Marines can attack units that are sitting on the coast, blowing up your destroyers.
Mm-hmm.
So they have a purpose, but most people just use a bunch of, you know, battleships to kill all the units first and then send in the destroyer. Personally, and this kind of ties into one of the other topics we're talking about, I think the infantry and the marine are reversed in position. The marine should come at plastics, the infantry should come at penicillin. I think that's just a bit of an oversight in the tech tree. And if the marine did come earlier and the infantry came later, it would make a lot more sense.
Why even says in the chat, you probably have an armory by then and can get a new unit with amphibious right away. Some infantry more likely.
You can get amphibious, so yeah, that's fine, that's a promotion, but you can't get the increased embark defense, and that's actually what the marine has as a bonus. So basically, not getting it killed just by wandering out in the water. Tie into what I was talking about with the tech tree about Marines and infantry should be switched. There's a topic by J51 about longswords and Great War infantry, and his question's just, does anybody else think it's odd that these two units can be upgraded with the research of only one additional tech? And what he's talking about is longswords to gunpowder muskets and Great War infantry to purely infantry. He clarifies a little later that one extra tech does mean going from replaceable parts into radio, then to plastics to upgrade Great War infantry to infantry, and of course going from steel to physics, then to gunpowder. So it's actually two techs per. But they are the shortest upgrade lines in the game between the two of those.
I honestly, I must admit, I'm not that familiar with the Civ 5 tech tree because I kind of gave up on Civ 5 a while back. But, I mean, it depends. If there's other things of great value in that era, then I definitely think that that makes sense. It's a case of priorities. Either you beeline for the strong military units or you grab all the other useful stuff to build, I don't know, improvements and whatnot.
Yeah, so. The long swordsmen, I don't see. I use them a lot, and I don't always go for the musketeers. Great War Infantry, I didn't even know they existed. I'm always straight past them. There's no upgrade path there. It's just infantry.
And that's partly why I was suggesting that infantry and Marines should get switched.
Yeah.
Because the rifles to replaceable parts, Great War Infantry, is actually a little longer than it would seem. And it's much harder. You're going from rifles at 34 combat strength to Great War Infantry at 50. When with the new combat system, that's actually quite a bit of a boost that you get there. And if you're fighting that fight, it's pretty rough. But then going from 50 to 70 in one shot just makes it even worse.
Yeah, and so quickly, too.
Whereas the difference between long swords and muskets is only about 4 or 5 combat strength. You're not getting that big of a boost by jumping past long swords to hit gunpowder units. Well, with the exception that you no longer have to use iron.
Yeah, and, you know, that's not much of a penalty.
Yeah, there's iron everywhere now.
Yeah, with Great War Infantry in the modern era, and so is the infantry, we're talking about a difference between 50 combat and 70 combat, as well as 55 hammers. It's one of those things where, yes, riflemen then upgrade to Great War Infantry, but you won't have the situation where your long swords will upgrade to Great War Infantry. So in the end, I have a few Great War Infantry just because I was constructing riflemen, thinking about, oh yes, they're actually going to get me to infantry. And in certain situations, depending upon who I'm fighting, if I'm looking at my mostly riflemen and I decide, it's going to be that much longer to infantry, not too long, but long enough, and I would like to take advantage of the little bit of combat boost between riflemen and Great War Infantry, then I will upgrade. But it's kind of one of those situations where it's kind of, I'm just passing through often. It's, you know, it's like when you're on a train, but a train doesn't necessarily stop at every station.
Express train! It's a win.
This train stops here. So in that particular game, I stopped there. But then, you know, the next 3 or 4 trains just keep on going through. They wave, but they keep on going through. They don't stop there. I don't stop at Great War Infantry. So I don't think it's a bad addition having Great War Infantry. And I think also a lot of people get hung up on the description and in the Civilopedia. Oh, is this supposed to be representative of World War One or World War Two? This, that, and the other thing. I don't get tied so much in the visual representation or the title. I look at it in terms of gameplay. What is the advantage of Great War Infantry versus riflemen versus infantry? And it's just one of those situations, those very specific situations where I need that slight edge. And how long is Great War Infantry on the map in terms of turns, especially when, you know, as you're going down the tech tree, typically playing quick speed, so it's even more exaggerated. They're really not around that often.
Well, the question is, once you get to rifling, your choice is, do I want more infantry or do I want to fly? You know, getting to Great War Infantry, yeah, that generally is going to give you some nice little boosts on the ground. You can even go to infantry and get very, very powerful melee unit, but if your opponent is flying around in planes and triplanes and has machine gunners, well, those little infantry are going to die very, very quickly. Yeah, it's only 2 techs apart, but if you blatantly ignore all of the oil-based units, you will probably get ran over, at least versus a decent opponent. The one big problem I have with Great War Infantry and the infantry being in the same era is that it breaks the generalized rule. That's not really a rule, it just seems to be what they've done, is that you only have one unit of a type that gets upgraded per era. So there's only one, you know, melee rifle-type unit in industrial, in Renaissance, in medieval, in classical, starting with the swordsman, you know, all the way up the line. But the atomic era is missing one. And that's probably where the infantry should be. And then you have more of a choice of going through the Great War stuff. Plus, with it being at penicillin, you'd need, like, biology and refrigeration, which would make it a little longer to get to. But for the subtext question, I guess, in the thread, even though we kind of mentioned it and then ignored it, steel and gunpowder, is the longsword upgrading to the musket that much of a problem? The only thing I have to say in that is, where are you going to move the musket? I mean, looking at the tech tree, there's just nowhere to move it. Rifling's only a few techs away if you use that logic, though it is quite a few techs away because you need all the way up to economics and all the other stuff, which requires you to go to education at the very least. So it requires quite a bit, but you don't want to move it too far away. And I wouldn't want to put something else in between steel and gunpowder. And if you move steel down, well, it's only got metal casting, so you have iron working to metal casting to steel, which is also very short. I think the design is built up in such a way that since gunpowder units are only about 4 combat strength higher than longswords, it's not that big advantage, so it's not really a problem. So it shouldn't bother you too much.
The split between the modern atomic information era, the tech trees up there, do they make sense?
Oh, you forgot to mention the only real important thing that Den wants on this.
Oh, and that is?
I know where this is going. Say it, Imagine, say it.
There was a poll.
Oh, okay.
Of course there was.
I've said it before and I'll say it again. That's a plus 25% modifier for getting a topic on this show.
Dan likes
that.
You know, I also use a random number generator, so. No, actually, no, I don't.
Well, you do. Your brain is kind of a random number generator.
Well, so is everybody's, really. It's just a matter of degrees.
The poll looks pretty conclusive.
Yeah, especially if you combine the two yes choices versus the two no choices.
Yep.
Almost 90% say yes. I'm in that combined group.
Me too. Yeah.
But now, of course, the question is it yes, period, or yes, but I'd change a couple of things, period, which also, by the way, does imply that you would change at least two things, because that's a definition of couple. But I guess if you only want to change one thing, then there really is no choice for you in this poll. That's a bit discriminatory.
A little bit. Is there a banana option?
There's a don't care.
It's not as interesting.
No.
You say you don't care, but you actually do care to answer the question
mm-hmm.
with an answer that's within context, as opposed to banana.
Mm. To care actually got care. More than no.
Yeah.
As of this recording, some people will probably listen to this and
they
then...
go vote up, yeah.
Yeah, and then what we're saying is not true anymore. I can see that happening, but that's okay. That's okay. And this thread was started by Jay Garlow. I think that's how it's supposed to be pronounced.
Basically, what it comes down to is most people liked the change, which is good. It adds a bit more flavor. Failing wanted to change nuclear fusion and particle physics as his suggestion for one of the changes. But I don't think he knows how to count. He says that he wants science and diplomatic victory dates to be at least a few more turns apart because they require the same amount of techs. And, well, I'm pretty sure I counted somewhere along the way in the time that we were working on it. And somebody who actually said it, Kwame, reminded him that the UN requires 56 techs and the spaceship parts require 73 techs. As per the new tech tree, if we change nuclear fusion and particle physics around, you would remove from the 73 techs all of mobile tactics, telecommunication, and everything below that, basically everything below globalization. So you would actually remove a vast quantity of techs and therefore make the spaceship victory that much faster than diplomatic victory, which doesn't seem to be his plan, but it seems to be his backwards plan.
Yes, math is a good thing.
Yes.
And, of course, yes, with that math, there's also the question of, well, how many beakers for each one of those techs?
Yeah.
But still, at some point, when you're talking about that number of technologies at that point in the game, it almost becomes secondary in practice.
From what I can tell, the only people that really bothers people is, again, keep floating along the same thing. Great War Infantry being so close to infantry. Some people don't like the names. The Real Future Age. Because Information Age replaced Future Age. If you think about it, only the giant death robot, the spaceship techs, or at least the later ones, those are about the only things, and maybe even the spaceship factory. Of all of that stuff in the information age, there's maybe four that are actual future tech stuff.
Yeah, they're future in the information era.
That's because we're not out of the information era yet in real life, therefore.
No, we've been in the info era for at least 40 years.
Information's a commodity? Who knew?
Yeah. Because we haven't finished the information era.
Forget about the future era. Just call it the science fiction era.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
There was this, of all places, article on CNN discussing the rebirth of turn-based strategy games, and they bring up things like XCOM, which is coming out again, the Civilization series, and others. Let's start out with Wild Civ, since that's where we're at. Well, we just have Gods and Kings, Civ series game, and an expansion, seems to be somewhat popular. Except for grouchy old men like me, who's not quite happy about all the developments. But yeah, there seems to be a certain revival, I would agree. I'm not sure if it's developing quite in the direction that I think the niche customer base really wants.
That's what Paradox games are for?
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, Paradox are technically not turn-based, but definitely have all the complexity and all things that that hardcore crew is after. But I feel that Civilization V has gone in a direction that, well, at least with the first vanilla, I haven't played Gods and Kings, so I shouldn't say too much, but it made the game in a way simpler and less interesting. Fewer decisions, longer waits, less to do per turn. And I've seen a lot of interviews with Sid Meier, in which he talks about game design. He's discussed the Civilization Revolutions for the console, all these modifications they made to make the gamers and customers happy. But one of the things he says is that the gamers and the customers might not exactly know what they really want. For example, they would reload the game every time they lost a battle.
Oh, maybe he doesn't understand his own customer base. He is getting kind of old.
Yeah, I think that might be the case. If you look at his most recent project, it's Facebook Civilization. Oh, you get lost.
Yeah.
That's flop. It's completely misunderstood what people loved about his original games and what kind of people loved the original games. That's my theory.
I think it's as much the marketing teams. They don't give the money up to the niche games anymore. You gotta get mass market or you don't get the game made at all.
Mm-hmm.
So they end up with all sorts of compromises that it grows the franchise, more people buy it, but it's not Civ 2, Alpha Centauri.
Yes, it's losing the original customer base.
Yep.
And that is a great tragedy, because, I mean, what are we going to play then?
Give it another year with Kickstarter coming up.
Yeah.
We're going to see those new titles get funded by the people who want to fund them. We won't have to be at the mercy of the big name publishers saying, this is a AAA franchise, you got to get Civ into 8 million hands.
That's just based on cost. AAA game means that they've spent 20 to 50 million, depending on how much they're willing to fund it, on the development of that game. At 50 million, if they've actually spent that much for some AAAs, like first-person shooters tend to, they actually do need to sell a lot of games to catch up.
$60
Yeah, at $60 each, that's more than a million copies sold just to break even, and that's not even covering most of the costs, because you're still spending money on top of the development. So yes, AAA games require a mass volume of purchases. Now, does that mean that somebody like 2K should be running a strategy game company like Firaxis? I would say no. But that's because 2K doesn't really understand the concept when their boss keeps talking about first-person shooters and consoles.
And how strategy games are not contemporary.
Yeah.
With things like Civilization Revolution, I look at Civilization World, the Facebook Civ game, like Civilization Revolution in the context of it is meant to appeal to a different segment of the gaming market.
Mm-hmm.
And then the question then becomes, how much time, energy, effort do you spend during initial development and then subsequent development to not only respond to those people who are interested in playing it, that kind of feedback, but then also what about your existing, your traditional market base, which would be players like us and the traditional and still present AAA title, which has a considerable overhead cost in terms of time and money, as opposed to not on a Civilization Revolution, but like a Civilization World.
Yep.
I think the big issue with Civ World that they've seen that we haven't seen in, say, Civilization V is subsequent support and updates. And I don't just mean the whole downloadable content argument, downloadable content versus an expansion. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about, strictly speaking, patchwork. Mm. I know Civ World, there hasn't been an update or a word in more than half a year. Nothing has changed there. And there's still criticisms coming about, and nothing is changing. And I think that is, it's the execution of a Civilization World that's fallen short, whereas even in Civilization Revolution, there were consistent updates after the game first came out, you know, a year, year and a half afterwards. And we're still seeing that with Civilization V almost 2 years after the game was released. So that's for Civ specifically, but more generally from CNN. We say the rebirth of turn-based strategy games, I know it can be an antonym, but I actually prefer the term resurgence, and it kind of gets to those games that don't have to be AAA. You don't have to try to get that AAA funding. Mm-hmm. You use a Kickstarter. You can use microtransactions, where something that's more niche, that you can start small, and then if that works, and then based on player feedback, you want to expand that experience, then you can get that money for that. You've already got that audience established. So therefore, the overhead that you're paying in the hopes that I got to sell a million copies to break even, you don't have that big of an issue. And actually, I think the more difficult thing, especially with turn-based strategy games where you get a lot of the niche, is if you want to cover turn-based strategy games or just strategy games, period, it's a matter of volume now. There are so many more choices just in a short amount of time, whereas strategy AAA titles, you look at them and it's, well, we can talk about them, but we're going to talk about the usual suspects. Mm-hmm. There's so much more now. There's so much to be able to cater to specific market types, like a Civilization Revolution, like a Civilization World, and then back to your traditional, including those that still like the single-player experience, mostly, if not exclusively.
Well, I mean, that's part of what I think the article is trying to talk about, is things are changing a little bit now. The 90s were all about the Nintendo boss talking about, if you can play the game with a blue dot, then it's a worthy game to make. Basically, graphics are excess. And then you rolled into the 2000s, where graphics was taking over because, well, they could. And then you started getting to the point where games were major on the graphics and light on the content. Content, I mean, strategy and other things like that. So there was a bit of a pain there. But for this resurgence for Dan, or the coming out of strategy, it has been 20-ish years since original real strategy games had come out. So it's not that surprising that they're coming up again, at least in the way things roll. And as you kind of alluded to, content and gameplay are starting to take over from graphics, because it doesn't cost as much to get the cool graphics anymore. So gameplay is becoming more important, because people are looking around going, yeah, it's pretty, but who cares? A lot
of
games.
We reached this plateau thing. They cannot get much better with the graphics. I mean, they can add more shiny and sparkly to it, but they're at kind of a bit of a ceiling. So now they have to catch the gameplay up to get people's attention.
And just to give more of an example to what Dan was talking about with Kickstarter, and that Endless Space, it's one of the games that I've been playing on my Twitch account, entirely Kickstarter funded, or at least crowdsourced funding, whereas if you pre-ordered, you got a pre-access and were able to vote on everything about the game. And it's a turn-based space strategy game. So it in particular harkens back to the 90s original Master of Orion style, skipping that Mu 3 debacle. That's coming up. There's, you know, Paradox is kicking out a ton of games. But I think one of the things you have to watch out for now in this environment is what's being called strategy game is being thrown out there. I do not consider tower defense games as strategy as compared to everything else that actually is considered a strategy game. Yes, there's strategy within it. There's strategy within almost every game, but that doesn't make them strategy. Not as the genre. First-person shooters have strategy. That doesn't make them strategy games.
Agreed.
The niches are getting bigger. it's not just strategy is the niche. It is, you have RTS, you have TBS. This happened a long time ago, but it's the volume, as Dan was talking about, is getting better, even though there is quite a bit of boring stuff.
Zippy's Guitar says in the chat, Plants vs. Zombies isn't a strategy game. I would say that no, that is not a strategy game.
Is too.
Is not. It's a tower defense game.
Tactics.
Yeah.
Tactics.
But I have strategies.
Every game has a strategy. Life has a strategy, but it's not a game or a strategy game.
A bunch of corn drop cats. I bet those work.
Yes, let's talk about the strategy of camping in first-person shooters.
Yeah.
What I find interesting about the article is they don't mention that XCOM was slated to be a first-person shooter until everyone jumped up in arms and Firaxis.
Yeah. Yeah, that's actually something that would have made this article a newsworthy article rather than just a blog post by some random person. It would have been newsworthy had they said, the reason it's resurging is because 2K tried to make a stupid first-person shooter out of a strategy game and people said, stop that. They didn't cancel it, but it still hasn't come out yet.
Yeah, it's on the back burner.
Also to the resurgence, when, you know, especially when we talk about strategy games not being contemporary or even just general comments about, are strategy games dead? I think the question was, how come strategy games aren't visible anymore? Mm. Well, I think that they're doing a little bit better in being visible now and back to a lot of those greater choices from smaller developers with smaller overheads because they're also not trying to be the next Civ. They're not trying to be the next XCOM, the next Master of Orion. So we're being more visible now. We're being more vocal. And I think the industry's just kind of like, oh, you guys weren't dead. You were just really, really quiet.
Could be.
So we're taking that.
Yeah, well, the first-person shooters were talking over top of you all of the time. I think that's what...
Pretty much.
Yeah, and now that Activision has a first-person shooter releasing every month, people are starting to get tired of it and start to look for something better.
Just a little bit.
Yeah, but actually I think it's part of the general trend in gaming that back in the olden days, the 90s, like when UFO came out and Civ 1 and Civ 2 came out, people would play these games forever because they didn't have that many, right?
No, there wasn't that many releases a year.
No. And people couldn't afford them either, you know, because mostly kids bought them at that time. You know, it's those kids who are now in their 30s and older who have lots of disposable income, waste them all on computer games or spend them on. But I'm seeing a trend with myself and friends and everything that we play games for shorter amounts of time now, even if we enjoy them. We play them for, I don't know, at most, a few months, 2 months, and then time to move on. We're tired of it. It's great
yeah,
there and all that.
Yeah, DLC will come out, like with Fallout New Vegas. They had that want to go back and play through all over again.
Yeah, but it's not like it used to be when you played the same game for, I don't know, a year. Yeah, I mean, how many years did I play Civ 2? I don't want to think about it. I learned four languages at that time at least.
You know? That's
but just one more turn, right?
Right. Yeah.
Well, that's just the point about some of the replayability factors.
You know, John, when you talked about the olden days of the 90s, I got a little lightheaded.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 441-212-88-7659. That's 441-212-88-POLY.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
You can tell me about bad games all day long. I own a game store. People bring me these, and I cringe every time someone brings, oh yeah, you want that one? Oh, yep, sure. I will not comment on it.
I hope people are enjoying, or at least liking more, the technical quality of my voice. I am using software. Sounds like I'm in a room because I'm actually wearing my headset and not having my headset microphone against the speaker.
Well, this is John, or this is Chris at Apoliton with Dan.
We're now going to make like a tree and leaf.
And Majin?
I'm going to chop that tree down.
Maki?
I'm going to go over here because you guys are just, yeah, bye.
Jay?
And I gotta go open my store. Have a good one.
And I forgot someone? No?
No. Yourself?
That's all.
No, he introduced himself first because he thought he was important or something. I don't know.
Ah, yes. Right. I'm John. Yep. First and last. There we go. Alpha and Omega. Not to be pretentious or anything. All right. Time to log off, I guess.
Hi, everybody.
Recorded August 25th, 2012. Civilization 4 and 5 sound clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.